Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 106th podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. Today is a fun episode. It is always a delight to talk to Walter Carter over at Carter Vintage in Nashville. And I wanted to talk to him about his latest acquisition, this guitar that's being called the First Burst. It's a 1958 Les Paul Sunburst. It was kind of a prototype, and they've got it for sale right now, and you can hear all about it and its price. And I love hearing about where these things come out of the woodwork, because it's always fascinating. Every couple of years, some amazingly, ridiculously cool rare guitar is surfaces, and I love hearing these stories. And as an added bonus, Walter and I got into a nice conversation about guitar sales trends, what's selling right now for him at his store, what's maybe not selling so well, and we talked a little bit about acoustics and mandolins too. So if you are into the world of guitar collecting or interested in this First Burst, you'll want to stay tuned. Before I get to that, Fretboard Journal 36 is just about out. We are printing it right now. Derek Trux is on the cover. It is a great issue. We hope you will check it out. Now would be a great time to subscribe at fretboardjournal.com if you haven't yet. Our web store now takes PayPal and Amazon payments, as well as good old credit cards. Check out all the amazingly cool content we have on our site right now, including things like the old Tony Rice cover story from issue 5, the John Hartford cover story from issue 4, and many, many other gems from our 10-plus years of publishing. We just relaunched our website, and it is so cool to finally be able to share some of these stories and make them look pretty and make them look good on your mobile device. And we're just having a blast unearthing all of this rare old content of ours. I do want to mention, lastly, the Fretboard Summit is in full swing. It's happening October 14th through 16th, 2016, in San Diego, California. Many, many, many great vintage guitar collectors and enthusiasts and dealers will be there. TJ Thompson's going to be there. I know Stu Cohen from Music Emporium is going to be there. We've got Bill Collins showing up, and many, many others, along with some truly exceptional musicians. It's a three-day gathering where we just get to hang out and chat about guitars, hear guitar stories, hear some cool panels, deep dive into some interesting and sometimes obscure historical stuff. It's a blast. If for anyone who went last year can attest, it's a truly interesting thing that is unlike any guitar show you've ever been to, and we're very proud of it. So go to fretboardsummit.com if you want to hear more about that. And without further ado, here's Walter Carter. So Walter, congratulations, the First Burst. Where did this thing come from?
It came from from the original owner, who lives in Memphis and has a 14-year-old boy. He went into the OK Hauk music store. His father drove him in, of course. And that's the store where Elvis and Scotty Moore bought their guitars. And he walked into the store, and there was a guy there doing a demonstration on a couple of new Gibson models. And he remembers the guy's name because he was such a good guitar player. It was Andy Nelson, who was a Gibson clinician and sort of a gadfly of the era in trying to get new models made. He was responsible for the George Gobel L5CT and instrumental in the ES-335, or excuse me, 355, and also in the Gibson Crest and the Epiphone Exelante. So anyway, Andy's main job, though, was as a clinician, and he was playing these guitars. So the kid liked the one with the cherry sunburst top, since that was a new thing.
Sure.
So he bought it a few months later, and there's a snapshot that he had taken of himself with a guitar and the amp that he bought, a Gibson amp, and that snapshot's dated April of 59.
Okay.
And it shows clearly the same wood grain and the three-piece top. That's one of the unusual features, or the unusual feature of the guitar. And he played it through high school and then didn't play it much anymore. And knew that a Sunburst Les Paul had some value. He had no idea where it ranked in the big scheme of things historically.
And
so
then
he still He brought it to us.
Okay.
He called us about it. He's 70 years old now.
Sure. And at the time, was there an upcharge for, you know, did he pay more than he would have for a gold top at that store?
I don't know what the price was. He said the last time he moved houses 15 years ago, he lost the original receipt. So he kept it all that time, but he didn't know exactly what the price was. I don't know if the price went up for gold tops. That would have been a sort of a demo model, or a you know, it wasn't, you know, in a way it was a prototype, but and it, with the three-piece top, you know, it wasn't quite what became the standard spec, so I doubt if it was more than a gold top.
Sure. And what else, does it have any other things that kind of separate it from a regular burst?
Other than the three-piece top, it's a straightforward, what we call a burst today, with a cherry, with yellow to red cherry sunburst.
Yeah.
There are other previous guitars that were noted in the ledger books as having a special finish with some sort of cherry. But none of those, there were at least three of them, and those do not have the finish that would be recognized today as a, you know, a burst finish.
What did those look like?
Well, one of them is a uniform cherry stain on the top. Another one looks like it was maybe Gibson's, what we call tobacco sunburst, you know, yellow to brown, that was then sprayed over entirely with cherry stain. And that cherry stain is faded, so you see residues of cherry in the yellow part of that one, sort of a cherry highlighted wood grain. And then the other one, the third one, is a sort of light cherry to dark cherry. So not, there's no yellow in it. It looks more like one of the Gibson high end mandolins from the teens.
Interesting.
Like an F4 from 1918.
So. Sure. So you got this guitar, and what was your first reaction?
Well, he had emailed pictures first, after he called and then emailed some pictures. And as soon as I saw the serial number, it rang a bell, because I'd come across that number back when I was at Gibson and browsing through the ledger books. I'd come across this entry on May 28th. 1958, that said two special, it was abbreviated SPEC, or two LP for Les Paul, SPEC for special finish. So mm-hmm. two LP special finish that were shipped to CMI, which was Chicago Musical Instrument Company, Gibson's parent company. And at the time, I was looking through and writing a column for Gibson's website, and this would have been in 98, I think, and the website was called Adventures in Archives. So I just went through whatever old stuff that I, you know, felt like going through and just writing a little column about it. And I was actually writing this one in response to the request from a customer to find another Les Paul in the ledger books, and I came across that, and this entry for the special finish, and noted that this could be the first Sunburst Les Paul, so I don't know. And there was another entry for a cherry finish Les Paul, and that turned out to be the one that was a uniform cherry finish. So that was in 98. In 99, the book, The Beauty of the Burst, comes out in an American edition. And the earliest one in there is number 8-3096, and that's owned today, or was then, by Slash.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was one of the numbers in the entry. I mean, I that rang a bell, of course, immediately. So that left this one other one in that entry, which would be 8-3087, unknown. So for since like 99, Slash's has been what we would probably be the earliest one with cherry sunburst. Some of these others had not turned up yet at that time. So, you know, it somewhat it's speculation as to what else was made before slashes, but that was the first with what we would call, when people refer to a burst, that's what they're talking about, is the yellow to red finish.
Yeah.
So when this guy sends me pictures and I see the other serial number, that rings a bell. I double-checked. And actually went out to Gibson to get the ledger, to get a copy of the entry in the ledger, just to double check it. I knew that was the serial number, but I wanted some proof for the doubting Thomases of this world.
Sure.
And I was pretty sure that was the guitar. It looked in the pictures to have a two-piece top, and when I talked to the owner, he said, no, it's got a three-piece top. Which is unusual, but certainly understandable if they're experimenting with finishes and they just go pull a couple of meant-to-be gold tops off the line.
Sure.
before they're painted. So they paint them with these new finishes to send them to his corporate office. There's not a new spec that says it's got to be a center two-piece top with a center seam. There's no spec on this model at all because it doesn't, these are all experimental. So, as it turns out, one of the earlier, the light cherry to dark cherry guitar also has a three-piece top. And they're gold tops that people have stripped to refinish, and some of them have three-piece tops. So I think that supports the idea that it was pulled off the line. I can tell you that this guitar has not a speck of gold finish anywhere in the cavity. So it was, this is the original finish on the guitar.
Yeah.
It wasn't a refinished gold top. We've gotten several messages. As soon as somebody says three-piece top, they it must be refinished, but no, it's not. I was pretty sure, 99% sure of what this guy had. And so I called him and I said, that seems like a pretty early guitar, and I asked him a little bit more about what he'd done to it, and if he'd had it refinished or anything, and he said no, he had broken the jack plate and replaced it and the jack, and he'd broken the switch washer, the poker chip,
mm-hmm.
and replaced that, and replaced one tuner. So I asked him, I told him I thought it was a pretty valuable guitar, pretty early, and a few weeks later he brought it into the shop, and we went over it in minute detail and had several other people look at it just to get second opinions, and I sent some pictures around to more people. So, there's no doubt that it's authentic, and it's that one in the ledger entry.
Yeah. Well, beyond its value as a historic artifact, how does it sound? Does a three-piece top affect the tone at all?
No, that's... a couple of people have played it, primarily Ed King of Lynyrd Skynyrd, who just fell in love with it. That doesn't affect the performance at all.
Yeah. Did you find, I'm sure you've seen plenty of bursts refinished and gold tops. Did Gibson use kind of the same quality wood for the three-piece tops as they did the two-piece tops for the bursts?
Yeah, the quality of the wood would be the same.
Okay.
Yeah, they just started making it so that the center seam was the seam was in the center.
Yeah.
Most of the gold tops are two piece, but the seam was just sort of wherever it fell, and then they started trying to make the tops look good, or at least on some models, it's mm-hmm. it's not nearly as prevalent as you believe from the way the reissues look.
Yeah.
Maybe 1 in 10 looked like that of the originals,
sure.
with the heavy tiger stripe grain. But they did, they used a, book matched two-piece top as soon as they settled on the spec.
Yeah.
For the cherry sun. Then, as soon as they realized people are going to see the wood grain of the top.
So beyond what the previous owner had to replace, a few odds and ends, did this guitar need any work when you got it?
No, it played beautifully.
Amazing.
It still has the original frets. He played it maybe for 3 years, I don't even think he played it much after high school. It was sitting around his house. His stepchildren just played it. It was just a house guitar to them. So it's we're fortunate that it didn't get kicked around and beat up or broken. The tuner that he had replaced, it was kind of funny. He said, let's see, I had that replaced, it was just a few years ago. It was in 63. And the shop that he took, I don't know which shop he took it to, but they had some earlier, the period correct tuners.
Nice.
Saved
you some work.
Right, yeah, it's got the single ring Cloison Deluxe on it, but the button on the replacement one did not shrivel up like the others do, so it sticks out like a sore thumb, but it's the exact period replacement part. The jack plate's homemade, and the switch washer is just a modern replacement.
Yeah.
But there's no work, hardly any setup work. It's almost like it was just out of the box, or in a time machine that still plays and sounds great.
Yeah. Well, now the million-dollar question, maybe not $1 million, I don't know. How do you value something like this?
Well, it's hard to value, because you got to, when you say it's the first, you got to qualify it. And you can't just say it's the first Sunburst Les Paul, because there are others with a Sunburst finish of various sorts. So it's the first that we know of with the yellow to cherry sunburst finish that became the standard finish on the model.
Yeah.
The three-piece top is out of spec, so some people might discount it for that. I think they would get over it quick because it's actually the centerpiece especially is highly flamed, and the finish is just beautifully intact cherry. So you value it more than the next one, or the one that's five down the line.
Mm-hmm.
We got suggestions from various dealers, with just pricing it all over the range from, $250,000 to $1 million.
Yeah.
So, we had already decided or thought, we arrived at a price on our own first before we asked for other opinions, so our opinions wouldn't necessarily be influenced by others, and we decided to price it at $625,000.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, that turned out to be a middle ground between the opinions of a lot of other dealers.
And I know a steady stream, at least according to Facebook and Instagram, of celebrities have come to see this thing. Any takers yet?
It's still here. It's still available today. Some people, some pretty big names who've come in to look at it, and then just a lot of people who aren't big names who are thrilled to be able to see it.
Yeah. You guys always have such a knack for finding the coolest stuff. This is definitely pretty noteworthy, but every week I am in awe of where you uncover this stuff. I don't know how you do it.
Well, in truth, most of it comes to us.
Yeah.
I didn't know this guy, the owner of this guitar, and I don't think we had any mutual friends. I think he looked around for and just believe what people told him about us.
Yeah.
And we've had, all of the, the real high-profile instruments that we've had have come to us. We're not out hounding people or beating the bushes, so to speak, to try to push people into bringing their stuff to us. And I think, our... One of the main points in our business plan was to have a really comfortable kind of store where customers would be comfortable,
yeah,
looking at old guitars and playing old guitars, and to be nice to people. And it sounds as obvious, but if you remember probably your own experiences in guitar stores as
sure.
a kid.
Sure.
Some were good and some weren't. And I, speaking for myself, the guys who weren't so nice to me as a kid, that, you know, I never went back in their stores as long as I lived. And the ones who were nice, you know, I kept in contact with. And, and later on, when I had money to spend, that's where I spent it.
Sure.
So that was from the beginning. Just the attitude and the atmosphere here was what we thought was really the only thing that could distinguish us, possibly, from other vintage dealers. I mean, everybody sort of has the same opportunity to get guitars, and you know, most vintage dealers have some really good guitars.
Yeah.
And so we decided that, you know, rather than a heavy advertising campaign or a real aggressive sort of acquisition campaign, that just our, you know, building a reputation would in the long run work for us best. And
sure.
it seems to be the case.
That's everyone I know. I have yet to come to your shop, but everyone I know who's been there, and we featured it in our magazine,
yeah.
loves it.
Oh, yeah.
What I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you, you know, we're talking about bursts, and obviously the value has gone up and down and up over the years.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, you're such an authority, and I've always thought your pricing was pretty fair. You know, what trends are you seeing right now as of May 2016 in guitars? Are there some things that are just flying off the shelf the minute you get it, and some things that are maybe a little softer?
Well, the overall trend, and especially for high-end stuff, I think is sort of positive but cautionary.
Yeah.
The market has stabilized and come back a little bit from the fall, the crash of 2008, 2009. But people are still wary, and they don't want to, you know, at that time you could buy today at full ask. In 30 days, you could sell and make a profit.
Mm-hmm.
And those days are gone, and I think buyers realize that. So they're wanting to just feel comfortable that they've paid a price that they can at least get back out of, and they're not getting into a speculative market. So that, you know, that makes high-end sales a little bit tougher. But this, as it always happens when markets are flat or going down, the sort of blue chip instruments remain stronger, and the sort of the tag along instruments maybe not so strong. So, you know, when a 330, when the market's hot, not only ES-335s but 345s and 355s mm-hmm. are sell well too, but when the market's not strong, the 335s will still sell, but the other two models that aren't as desirable are harder to sell. So, you know, for the high end stuff, and that applies to acoustics too. You know, I think the market is solid, but not. You know, not going crazy like it has at times in the past. There's certain, what we really see a lot of is people looking for a vintage acoustic or electric that's beat to hell. You know, these are players who want a deal on a guitar.
Yeah.
You know, they'll say, yeah, I want a pre-war dreadnought. Condition is no issue. In fact, the worse, the better for me. So, you know, and they're finding you really can't kill a good Martin or Gibson.
Yeah.
And the ones that sound good sell. You know, they're going to be priced according to condition. And the worse the condition, cosmetic condition at least, the better the value is for people who are looking for a good player. So if any part of the market is hot, I'd say that is.
Interesting.
You know, I think that requires a good repair staff, to get the guitars into that kind of shape. But you know, overall, I think it's a strong market. You can get burned, and you can put a lot of money into inventory that's not going to sell quickly if you're not careful or if you don't know what you're doing. So it's not the kind of market for the uninitiated to jump in. But we're doing pretty well.
Is it just me, or does it seem like more and more guitars, more and more guys, maybe like this guy with the burst, are coming out of the woodwork and trying to thin the herd a little bit? Are you getting more and more calls for people trying to kind of get rid of some of their maybe B and C level guitars?
Well, there are a lot of dealers, collectors, a lot of collectors who are sort of aging out.
Yeah.
And I think some of the older dealers, sort of the first generation vintage dealers, believe that we're just headed for hard times because all the baby boomer generation who bought these guitars, they're now aging out and selling their collections. And that is true to a great degree. But there are also younger players and collectors stepping up to buy these instruments. And I think maybe some of the more established or first-generation dealers maybe aren't seeing that clientele. But it's there.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are people liquidating collections. That's always happened, I think, in any collectible market. You know, people amass collections, and at some point, they get rid of them, whether they auction off the whole thing as an estate or whether they just start selling stuff individually. It happens a lot. It happens at every end of the scale, whether it's a guy with 10 guitars or a guy with 100.
Yeah.
And then there are other situations too. We got 80 guitars from Steve Earle, and that wasn't even half of his collection. That had to do with the divorce.
Yeah,
and that's a traditional thing. He's not the first to have
he's not
to raise some money by selling off some parts of his collection. So,
think there's hope. There, you see young people coming through your doors who are
absolutely
jazzed about guitars and have enough money to keep this going.
Yeah, to agree. Now, they're not many. I mean, there are not many people, young or old, who've got the money to put into a pre-war Martin Dreadnought or a Sunburst Les Paul or even a '50s Strat.
Yeah.
But there are few. There never were that many people.
Yeah.
So it's always been a real small segment of the market. It's still there.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on, I know you've carried a handful of today's builders, Wayne Henderson and Stephen Gilchrist and a few others. What are your thoughts on that market?
Well, I think that's a strong market, but for a dealer, and Gilchrist is an exception. I'll explain that in a second. But for a dealer to be successful in carrying a new line or instruments from an individual maker, that maker has to stop selling direct because it just undercuts. Even if the maker doesn't cut prices, it's any buyer would rather deal directly with the maker of a guitar,
sure,
a personal guitar for him, than buy it through a dealer. So it's really difficult to be successful with lines from individual makers if they're still selling, if they're dealing direct with customers. In the case of Gilchrist, we represent him. And so in North America, at least, you can't get a Gilchrist except through us. So that's been very successful. We usually order a few more from him than we have orders for at the time, at that particular time, and they're usually bought by the time that he finishes them. And we work sort of the same way with Paul Duff, another Australian mandolin maker. We essentially just buy out all of his production. It's not quite the same agreement where we are his distributor, but we make it impossible for someone else in the U.S. to get one of his mandolins. So, you know, it works really well in those situations, provided, of course, that the instrument is of top quality. And then we've had varying successes with other makers. Not so much, too much with guitars, but with Ellis mandolins.
Yeah,
it's a small maker with not too many retail outlets. You know, we've done well with them. So it's just a matter of trying to find the right matchup.
Yeah, what's different about the guitar market, you think?
I don't know. I think it boils down to the direct sales. But even with, it could be that we're viewed more as a vintage store.
Yeah.
There's some electrics and acoustics that we've been successful selling used models quickly, but when we get the new ones in that are, you know, 20% higher, as they should be, new with warranty, then all of a sudden the sales slow down.
Yeah. With the exception of Wayne Henderson, whose guitars sell for exponentially more than he horse-traded or, you know, sold them for.
Yes.
Are you finding people trying to sell guitars that they may have ordered 5-10 years ago for $10,000 from some boutique maker, and they think that it's still worth that, but it's not? Or are those going up in value? What are your thoughts there?
Well, yeah. Everybody wants to get their money back. They don't want to think that they lost money on a guitar. So it's not just the guys who've paid the premium price for a guitar from a boutique maker. It's the guys who've bought a vintage guitar prior to 2009.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's sort of a, you know, reality check for these people. And I don't insult people's intelligence by explaining to them that if they, but I, sometimes I wish I could, that if they bought stock at $100 a share, and now that stock's worth $50 a share, they shouldn't expect to get $100 a share.
Sure.
As simple as that. And you know, the market is the market for these guitars, and it's for a lot of them, it's less than what they paid, and most, you know, they'll admit it. They'll, you know, they'll accept it in the stock market or even the real estate market.
Sure.
But it's a hard thing to accept for some reason when it comes to guitars.
Yeah. Well, I know some guitars, like, you know, 70s Fenders are now sort of becoming collectible. What took the biggest hit between 2009 and now in terms of value?
Well, you know, Strats were always subject to the term Strat Mania from the late 80s.
Yeah.
And I think they've... they took a pretty big hit. They're back at, I think, what people would say is a reasonable price now.
Mm-hmm.
No, I don't. If they were volatile before the crash, then they're still a little bit volatile. And those are the ones that probably took the biggest hit. I don't know that Martins took a huge hit. They Archtops really never recovered from the time when Scott Chenery and Akira Sumura were removed from the market.
Yeah.
They drove that market, and it fell on its own before the general economic crash happened. And it's really... Guitars, pretty much, archtops today are not bringing any more than they did back then.
Yeah. Are there any other facets of this market that are driven by one or two individuals?
Not that I can.
Okay.
That I can tell. Yeah, the banjo market is kind of funny. That's the flathead pre-war master tone market is a different animal unto itself.
You guys deal in those, right? Or do you kind of...
Yes, we do.
You do.
Yeah, we do deal in those. And it's, you know, like I said, it's just that's a world of its own, and it's a completely separate set of knowledge that you need to deal with that. They're, it's really much more difficult, I think, to get into to deal in those kind of banjos than it is in vintage guitars, at least for us. And you have to be careful and rely more on experts.
Yeah. Is the market strong there?
To some degree. And it's hard to, you know, a lot of those sales are individual to individual, so it's hard to know exactly, you know, where that market is.
Yeah.
And it's a fairly small group, you know, bluegrass banjo, and especially the group of bluegrass banjo aficionados who would have the money to, you know, to spend anywhere from, you know, 30 to over 100,000 on a banjo.
Yeah.
That's a very small group.
Well, Walter, thank you so much for talking, and congratulations on the latest acquisition.
Good to talk to you.